the world is being destroyed by capitalism. Anybody that thinks that you can save the world with capitalism, no matter how reformed, is an idiot. Like, yeah, it's had its chance.
Hello and welcome to episode 41 of Let Them Eat Cake. My name is Jack. My co-hosts are John and Ace. Today we are talking to Black Redguard, a pragmatic Maoist and member of the Democratic Socialists of America. He is also a political YouTuber and streamer covering geopolitics and history from a Maoist perspective. We get into Mao himself, China, and the ideas behind the ideology and the people who take it too far. But before that, let's get into some headlines.
So first story I'm covering today is about Tumaj Salehi. He's an Iranian rapper that was arrested on a charge called corruption on earth. He's a very vocal political activist. He's spoken out during the Jina Amini protests in Iran. The lyrics of his music are constantly speaking out against the Iranian regime. So the Iranian regime has constantly pushed this idea that the protests are color revolutions funded by foreign nations. So in his arrest, he was associated with these, I believe is what happened, right, Ace?
Yeah, he was released on like bail and these like certain conditions on November 18th. And at this point, he'd already been in prison for like over 200 days. And so they release him. And on the 27th of November, he releases this video where he speaks about how they treated him in prison. He was abused and things of that nature. And he'd made some complaints to the prison that he was in, obviously, because he wasn't being treated properly. And the rest of the video, he was basically just thanking people. But then on November 30th, he was arrested again and taken to an undisclosed location. Although, according to some people, he was taken to the Dastgir prison in Isfahan on December 3rd. So he'd been transferred over there. And from my understanding, the Dastgir prison, it's one of those prisons that is like, there's a lot of accounts of human rights abuses there and that it's overcrowded. So there's a lot of people in that prison and a lot of executions take place at that prison. The Iranian intelligence also have their own interrogation wards in that prison alongside the police. So yeah, not a great place to end up. And I think the prison, the actual number of prisoners is like debated between like 5,000 to 8,000, but the way the prison's set up, like it's not meant to house that many people, regardless of whether the number is 5,000 or 8,000. It's not that big.
Yeah, okay. So that's kind of where these accusations of the confessions being coerced probably come from then, yeah?
Yeah, I'm not sure which prison he was at when he was released on the 18th, but I'd imagine if he's in that prison in Isfahan, it would be very easy to get some, you know, things that are set against his will that he doesn't actually mean to say, like coerced confessions, things of that nature. And as you were saying about these accusations against him working with foreign intelligence or whatever, like the whole color revolution thing, that would make sense that he would be transferred to that prison because the Iranian intelligence is present there and they've got their own interrogation wards going over there. So yeah. So his birthday was actually on December 3rd when he was transferred to the prison. And people say that he's probably in solitary confinement. And yeah, so he turned 33 and a lot of people celebrated by passing out food to child laborers, child workers, because that was kind of one of also his big things. He was like a big workers' right advocate. He was against a lot of children going to work, which is unfortunately a common occurrence in Iran and a lot of places, really. But yeah.
So the crime, corruption of earth crime, it's almost like their version of high treason. But because the Ayatollah basically is church and the state, if you insult the state, you insult the Quran, basically. It's how he frames it. And so like that means death. Anytime there's a musician in Iran, they're always going through these mock executions and end up having to either get killed or most of the time they end up getting out of the country because musicians tend to have audiences that end up being outside pressure. But normally they're really like small guys, not like this guy's size.
Yeah, that's the other thing on the topic of, I mentioned it earlier, but on the topic of execution, a lot of executions are carried out at this prison. I think like we're talking 200, over 200, close to 300 within the last a little over 10 years or so. So that's a pretty high number.
And so the second story I'm going to cover is a clash between the US and China in the South China Sea. On December 4th, 2023, a spokesman for the People's Liberation Army of China announced that the USS Gabriel Gifford sailed into Chinese waters without prior notification and violated Chinese law. That's a quote from them, an accusation that probably shouldn't be taken lightly until you realize that these Chinese waters are a group of islands called the Spratly Islands. They're a cluster of shoals, reefs, and small islands contested by China, Vietnam, Philippines, Brunei, Malaysia, and Taiwan. This is despite the majority of the islands falling into international waters or the exclusive economic zone of the Philippines. For clarification, this is a map of the area. China is nowhere near these islands, quite a distance away from them, in fact. So it's interesting to see that China and Taiwan both have claims, considering that the map has to be stretched out to even include them. The accusations are specifically for the Second Thomas Shoal, located roughly 350 kilometers from the Philippines, within the Spratly Islands. In response to these accusations, the US said the USS Gabriel Giffords was conducting routine operations in international waters in the South China Sea, consistent with international law, in a statement on December 4th, as they have for decades. They continued. This follows multiple recent actions by the Chinese Navy to bully Filipino ships and prevent them from operating freely within their own EEZs. Filipino-US relations have recently increased because of the recent actions of China and their absurd claims over the South China Sea, with the US holding joint patrols with the Philippines in late November. The current Spratly dispute is over this particular piece of land, and China sees increased cooperation with the US as a direct threat to their ability to bully their South China Sea neighbors without repercussions. The Philippines intentionally grounded the BRP Sierra Madre, one of their Navy ships, on the Second Thomas Shoal in 1999 to stake a physical claim on the island, which is kind of funny, and they've kept a marine deployment on that ship ever since. Recently, China has been trying to stop them from resupplying them, and this has obviously caused tension because they're Philippines military. So it seems like the US is the one that's maintaining the Philippines' ability to resupply them. And that seems to be why China is particularly annoyed at this time. But we will see. Just a very interesting conflict, considering how far away China is from all of these islands and how much their nine-dash line impedes upon the economic zones of almost every country in the entire area.
So, democracy update. Last week, I touched on Venezuela voting to invade their neighbor. That ended up being like a bigger story that started blowing up. We still don't know if it's going to happen. The U.S. is holding joint military exercises. But the big thing that's going on here is exclusive economic zones. There's a lot of offshore oil, and Venezuela just wants more, apparently. Another vote, Putin announced that he's running for president. And I was joking earlier about why would we care? Because, you know, it's like Assad announced he's running for president. Who gives a shit? But I think this is significant because Ukraine was supposed to hold elections next year, but they're at war, so they've postponed elections. So I would just take note of this and expect that rhetoric is going to do this thing where they say that Russia is more democratic than Ukraine because they actually have a vote. And then there's back in episode 22, we covered a lot of Asia and Pacific elections, one of those being Bangladesh, basically saying that there's not really an election. You know, that's going to be another dictatorship winning, but there is elections in January. Recently, last month, there's been protests by the garment workers. I think people may have seen this. They met their demands to raise their wages, but we've talked extensively specifically about Bangladesh and the ready-made garment industry there and, like, you know, its impact on the climate and its impact on slavery and all these things. But the president of Bangladesh, she basically built that industry. That's her industry. So she's largely tied to the garment industry. So she was already in heat because of that. But because it's basically a dictatorship and, you know, you'll see Ortega lock people up who are his opponents. Lots of countries do this type of thing where you start jailing political opponents, start banning things. I think Ace, you have more on this, but the opposition has held a protest for these January 7th national elections that are going on. But the US has been tying itself to it for a while now because they have this whole like facade of being the protectors of democracy. They've talked about how they're going to be in there making sure that they have safe and secure elections in Bangladesh, even though they're like, you know, sham elections.
Yeah, I mean, they held a pretty recent protest, and they're planning, the opposition is basically planning on boycotting And there's been a lot of word coming out that members of the opposition had been arrested and jailed and things like that. Obviously, the ruling party denies these allegations, but Human Rights Watch has a report coming out that about 10,000 opposition activists, so that's people who are just opposed to the current party, which is the Awami League that's been in power and is going for their fourth consecutive term, and just also people who are politically involved who are opposed to the Awami League, so party members and things like that. So 10,000 have been arrested since October 28th. A lot of opposition activists and opposition politicians have gone into hiding. So, I mean, seeing as they're going to boycott this election, it's kind of hard to have one when basically all your opponents think that what you're doing is a farce. So
okay, and then last two democracy updates. The U.S. Congress proves to be more worthless than the U.N. So they blocked the aid package for Ukraine and Israel. Both were being tied together. Every Republican voted against these aid packages, and their main gripe was border dispute. So probably what we're likely to see here is that they'll tie the border funding, also taking funds to go like pay border guards who do nothing instead of like paying for weapons for Ukraine. But at least, you know, it's, I guess it's less money to Israel. On that note, the UN invoked Article 99. This is the first time they've done it since the Bangladesh genocide by Zia-ul Huq. Like most things that the UN does, it's basically pointless. It's not going to do anything. But what it does is it's basically allows the Secretary General to force a vote for the Security Council. And so he invoked it about Gaza. So basically he's saying that when you invoke Article 99, you're saying that a war is like a threat to the world. So it's one of the most powerful things that the UN can do. But if you think about who's on that council, you have Russia, China, the US, you know, the Security Council forcing a vote and the U.S. being on that council doesn't really mean it's going to do anything. So not a lot of wins for democracy this week, I guess. Now, for the main story, this entire December, there's been quite the counteroffensive coming out of Idlib. We've seen an increase in Syrian rebel activity targeting Assad, which has resulted in retaliation, as always. Basically, whenever some Syrian soldier gets hit, they just send Grad rockets to this time it was the industrial district of Idlib. The lead rebel group in Syria, HTS, they have been advancing. Rumor has it they've made an oxygen mixture with their missiles. And if you look at their missiles, they're like blue when they fire. And I guess that means there's oxygen present in the flame or something. But they're faster and more reliable. So they've upgraded their munitions a lot with these rockets. And you can essentially give yourself a lot of rocket coverage when your guys move in there. On December 7th, there was a major battle. It was one of their main offensives of the month. They launched an infiltration campaign in western Aleppo. We've seen them do these before. We've literally seen these guys crawl in the desert and like take out Assad's guys before and like got the whole thing on camera. Some of these guys have been fighting since the Iraq War. Some even before that, because there's, you know, Chechens there too. But the clashes went for like 5 hours. And Assad's forces failed to retake the oil factory that they were fighting over that's been converted into a regime military barracks.
But I believe all 15 members of HTS were killed in the attack. It would also be important to mention that some of the HTS members were apparently suicide bombers. So,
I mean, yeah, I mean, that's to be expected, though.
Just for people who wouldn't know.
So it's 13. Well, we'll get into that in just a sec. 13 pro-Assad fighters, including 3 from Hezbollah, were killed. Lieutenant Colonel and commander of the garrison died in the attack. One of the guys was like a day away from retirement, too. So, yeah, there's a lot of photos and videos of kids being killed by this attack. A lot of people rightly saying, where's the protests for this? So, yeah, HTS using suicide bombers, HTS being the lead rebel group in Idlib. We were debating this earlier because we don't like using the term terrorist for people. But in 2017, they separated from Al-Qaeda. The leader of HTS was literally an Al-Qaeda in Iraq. He has a lot of military on-the-ground experience fighting the Americans. So that has translated really well for their militias. They're almost like the American operators fighting the Iraqi militia at this point. Like Assad's forces are ill-equipped. Not that they have a lot of gear to go around, but when they do these attacks, they like have commandos. Some of them will have plates and everything. So while you have suicide bombers, you have guys who actually have armor sometimes as well. Anyway, so throughout the Levant from Syria to Israel continues to be probably the bloodiest place next to the Donbass at this point. Gaza, probably worse than the average day in Ukraine right now, but maybe not when it was like Mariupol. But it's also population density of Gaza makes it brutal. And also, most people have seen this, but they basically push them south and then gave them a Hunger Games map on like what squares are going to be active for killing you. They have to reference a map and have internet to reference a map to see if they're going to get bombed today. It's really deranged.
But they don't want to see civilians get killed, and that's why they do
this. Oh, they don't care. Let's see what happens with this UN Article 99. I think, hell, at this point, by the time this comes out, it's probably already been voted on. Anyway, keeping with the theme of violence, here's Ace.
So, on December 2nd, there was a shootout in Guinea-Bissau's capital. You guessed it, Bissau. This is not Guinea. This is not Equatorial Guinea. This is Guinea-Bissau. It is north of Guinea and south of Senegal, and it's a very small country on the western coast of Africa. So on December 2nd, there's this shootout, and the country's president, Umaro Sissoko Embalo, basically has characterized it as a coup attempt. The shootout occurred when members of the country's National Guard released two ministers who were in jail. So the economy and finance minister, Suleiman Sidi, and the treasury secretary, Antonio Monteiro, and members of the country's presidential palace battalion basically went to rearrest the two men, and a shootout happens between basically two separate factions of the military, to put it simply. And these types of arrests are not uncommon in Guinea-Bissau, which is very corrupt and is essentially like a de facto narco trafficking state. That is a topic for a whole other episode. But both of those ministers had been arrested on the charges were misuse of government funds. And basically, the way the country's parliamentary structure is set up is the National Guard answers to the Ministry of Interior. So the way things are now, the National Guard is basically beholden to the opposition parliament, who's basically in opposition to the president. And so it's pretty likely that they were acting upon orders to free the two ministers from someone else within the government who may have wanted to see them free for whatever reason. And on December 4th, the president decides he's going to dissolve the parliament. And that's like the second time he's done this in almost 2 years. So that's that. And it's pretty likely it's some kind of like, it was like in some sort of inside job from someone within the government who wanted to see these two people free for whatever reason. And so, you know, the wing of the military that answers to the president said, no, you're not releasing these guys. Shootout happens. It is what it is. President decides that this is some sort of coup attempt and dissolves the government. That's kind of like the summation of it. Moving on to Nigeria, Nigeria's president, I believe his name is Tinubu, has ordered an investigation after a drone strike carried out by the military in the country's northwest killed, like, depending on who you ask, 85 to 120 civilians who were like in a village. Basically, that we're celebrating a religious holiday, a Muslim religious holiday of Maulid, which is a holiday that marks the birthday of the Prophet Muhammad. Now, not all Muslims celebrate this, but like a lot of them do, especially in West Africa. So that's some context on that. Additionally, at least 66 were injured, and the military was basically saying initially that the strike had inadvertently hit the civilians, but later they would specify that this is because the villagers had been mistaken for members of an armed group. So, I mean, again,
it's like a mistake. You know, wedding for an armed group. An armed group doesn't gather over 100 people together in like one area, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, it seems as though the central government in Nigeria is pretty pissed off about this whole thing. They want to see like an investigation. And I mean, the thing with the Nigerian military is there's kind of, you know, with the amount of armed groups there and, you know, the amount of civilian bloodshed that's kind of occurred there since the 60s and the 70s, there is a lot of suspicion about how the military like treats the civilian population when it's operating in these areas. So, you know, on the one hand, Nigeria obviously has a serious insecurity problem that they want to combat. But on the other hand, it's far more difficult to combat that when you have this distrust of the military that are present in the areas that they're operating in. So there's going to be an investigation and we'll see what happens. Obviously, organizations like the UN, Amnesty, Human Rights Watch are going to be urging Nigeria to have fair and impartial investigations into the incident. And staying on the African continent, we're going to go over to the Congo and the March 23rd movement, better known as the M23, within the last couple of days has captured the town of Mushaki and the town of, I'm going to butcher this, so apologies in advance, but Kilo Rirui. Basically, the reason these two towns are very important is because these towns are very close to the city of Sake, which is very close, like about an hour drive from the capital city of the North Kivu province in the DRC, which is where a lot of the rebel groups are very active, like in the countries kind of like east, the capital Goma. And basically by capturing these two cities, they've cut off land routes to Sake, which is very close to Goma. And basically what people are worried about is that this could spur the M23's possible expansion into attacking the capital city of North Kivu. So that's what concerns people.
And the UN peacekeepers are also leaving at the end of the year.
They're leaving at the end of the year. And earlier in the, like last month, they'd launched Operation Springbok, which was this thing where they'd take upon, the peacekeepers would basically take upon these defensive positions around Goma, because there were concerns then too that the M23 could attack Goma. On top of the UN leaving at the end of the year, the East African Community Peacekeeping Force, so for those of you who are unfamiliar, the East African Peacekeeping Force is basically like the East African Community. It's like this little sort of coalition of governments similar to like the UN, but for like East Africa, or like ECOWAS for West Africa, that includes Burundi, Kenya, Uganda, South Sudan, etc. And they're going to be withdrawing from the Congo as well. And they've already, some of the troops have already begun withdrawal. And so what this will probably spur upon is, the thing is when these peacekeeping forces come into a country, they have these like outposts and positions that they maintain control of. And, you know, nobody wants to, I guess, attack the UN peacekeepers. I mean, it happens, but it's not something that you want to do most of the time, depending on who you are. And basically, when this announcement came, the M23 and the Congolese government are saying that they're going to take control of the outposts that the East African Community Peacekeeping Force is leaving. So that'll spur further fighting between the two groups as they try to gain like outposts that the UN has left. We saw this in Mali, as the mission in Mali was leaving the northern part of the country. You would see, like, as UN troops were leaving, there would be attacks on UN vehicles by like Al-Qaeda linked forces. Tuareg militants would take over bases that were left by the UN and things of that nature. So yeah, and just to give you guys a little bit of background on the M23, they're basically this group that
we do have a lot of coverage about them as well. So
we have a lot of coverage about them on an episode with Modern Insurgents founder Antoine Brimbal. You guys should check that out. To give some context, following the two huge wars in the Congo in the 90s and the early 2000s, which were kind of spurred on.
Sorry, it's episode 32.
Yeah, and these wars were kind of spurred on because of the aftermath of the Rwandan genocide, when a lot of the groups that had perpetrated the genocide went and hid out in the Congo. And so it was this whole clusterfuck. And there were these like all these armed Tutsi groups, and the Tutsis were the people who were the subjects who'd been killed in the Rwandan genocide. And Rwanda basically went in and financed all these groups to go and hunt down like the Interahamwe and the Hutu power movement who'd carried out the genocide. In the process, they did end up killing a lot of Hutu civilians who were fleeing Rwanda because of the civil war. And the M23 has kind of stuck around ever since, because they say that like a lot of these Hutu groups are still kind of around in the DRC, and that the government of the DRC is backing them, things of that nature. Although there has been some evidence to suggest that when it's convenient for them, the M23 will work with these Hutu rebel groups that are still present in the DRC to this day. And even at one point, I think back in like 2006, they'd actually been integrated into the Congolese military, but due to some disagreements, obviously, that fell apart. And there is a lot of evidence to suggest that Rwanda is financing them and backing them, and sometimes will even send in troops to help them fight the Congolese military and then withdraw over the border to Rwanda, you know, give them weapons. And, you know, in return, the M23 might give them some coltan or, you know, minerals or things of that nature. And I think it's important to note that I think Rwanda is one of the world's largest coltan exporters, but doesn't have a single active coltan mine, which is suspicious, in my opinion. I don't know about you guys, but that's suspicious.
Kind of fucked up.
But yeah, although there's all this kind of like evidence to connect the M23 to Rwanda, and you know, given Rwanda's history in the Congo dating back to like the 90s, it would make sense. They continually and adamantly deny that they have anything to do with it. But, you know, that the evidence is really not backing that up. So that's that. And I just wanted to touch on one other thing is the Islamic State, or the so-called Islamic State, is getting more active in a lot of areas. There have been
Pakistan, Afghanistan has been really bad with them.
Yeah, there have been several attacks carried out by various affiliates of the group in Iraq and Syria. More so in Syria, but there have been two in Iraq that have been quite significant. And they're also looking to be more active in the Philippines as of recently. And for those of you who didn't know that they had an affiliate in the Philippines, they do. And over the last couple like weeks or whatever, they've been carrying out these attacks in the Philippines. They bombed a church, like a gymnasium, a university gymnasium that was basically being used as a church on a Sunday. Like a week or two ago, that attack was claimed by them. They've been attacking outposts belonging to the Moro Islamic Liberation Front, or MILF, in the last few weeks. They've carried out maybe like three attacks against them. And the Moro Islamic Liberation Front, they're one of the older and larger rebel groups in like the Philippines history, but they've kind of been in a process of disarmament. And how they even help the Philippines military fight against the Islamic State in the siege of Marawi back in 2017, I believe that was. And their whole goal is they wanted kind of like the area of the southern Philippines, which is majority Muslim, and a lot of the people are these ethnic group known as the Moro. They wanted them to have more autonomy and stuff. And that's a whole other topic for another day. But because they have all these outposts still in the southern Philippines, despite being in this process of disarmament, it's made for a bit of a target for these IS militants. And after a bit of a pause in Mozambique, where the Islamic State also has an affiliate, It appeared as though for like a month or two, they were kind of hiding out in the bush. You know, there were a lot of civilians who'd been displaced because of that conflict in Mozambique were able to return to their regions of origin. But it seems like they're heating up again. I mean, just 2 days ago, or 4 days ago it was, they carried out an attack against a Mozambican military outpost and just burned the whole thing down, basically. And yeah, that's something to watch out for. It seems as though the Islamic State across multiple fronts is trying to make a run for it again. I don't know if it'll ever parallel what we saw back in like 2014, 2015, but just keep an eye out for that is all I'm saying. You might see them in the headlines a bit more these days.
Looks like it's going to be a pretty violent year.
Yeah.
The way it's setting out, if you're thinking, how could it get worse? These places are all going to be affected by climate change as well. Yeah. So anyway, that's all for our news updates. Here is our interview with Black Red Guard.
We have a weapon more powerful than the British Empire. And that weapon is our refusal to bow to any order but our own. Any institution but our own.
I'm BRG. And I guess you could call me a communist content creator, even though I hate being defined by that term. It just seems so parasitic to me.
Is it better than BreadTube, though? Sorry to interrupt.
Actually, you know, BreadTube actually likes me a lot more than the organized Maoist movement in the United States. Like, I actually, like, I keep saying this, I get along better with anarchists than I do with whatever you want to call them, tankies, MLs, ML. Like, those people are just so fractious and ridiculous. Like, that's a sign that they really don't have any political power because they spend so much time arguing with each other and splitting off and fracturing and fighting and quarreling with each other, that it makes people be like, you know what? I don't want these people anywhere near power.
It's the genocide denialism for me. It seems to just be a common thing that ends up happening.
As a descendant of somebody whose ancestors were brought over here on literal slave ships and really haven't had all that good of a time in this country, I'm totally not down with genocide denialism. Like, yeah, I'm a black person. Yeah, what do you expect me to say? You know what?
Yeah, exactly.
My ancestors were kicking it on those fucking plantations. Let's open them back up, but let's put everybody on them now.
So a lot of people are talking about how the Progressive Caucus is the future and how we should just support the Progressive Caucus. You know, like Kyle Kalinske, he just had that debate that went viral with a genocide denier and That's basically what his argument was, is that you shouldn't vote like anyone but Biden.
My question is this, like, why would you, like, I think Hassan calls them debate perverts, but like, why would you willfully seek out the most idiotic, like Vosh does this too. Like, he had that fucking kid from Midwestern Marks on. Like, I don't like any of these people. Vosh is a fucking moron. But like, why do you seek out the most idiotic, easily caricaturable, like, people on the internet? Like, does anybody really think that Eddie Liger is going to establish a People's Republic of the United States? No. Like, he's not a serious person. He's just a white kid with a wrestling scholarship who thinks that he knows something because he skimmed a few books. Like, none of these people are seriously doing politics. It's just noise.
So, are you implying you are serious about politics, though? Doing serious politics? Is that what you're implying?
Well, I am in a political organization called DSA. You might have heard of it. But,
can you tell, for people who don't know, can you say what that stands for?
Democratic Socialists of America. They're very widely memed on the internet. And I used to meme them and mock them and make fun of them as well. But, like, since I've actually joined them and have been going to events, like, they're actually a pretty cool group of people. Granted, there's many there's interest groups or groups that are centered around ideology. They're called caucuses. Like, you've got you've got MUG, Marxist Unity Group. You've got Red Star. You've got Socialist Majority. Various different types of groups of people. So whatever your politics are, hell, there's even an old school liberal caucus called North Star. They released something about Biden promoting a class struggle campaign or something today. So like, there's people of all types in DSA. And before, what my idea of organizing was to basically form this like nebulous Maoist party out of thin air. And like, this party would instantly be able to wage protracted people's war. But then like, I started studying and I was like, you know what? That's a very, very good way to get yourself thrown in prison for life or end up bleeding out in a Vaco somewhere. And the thing with the masses of working class people in the United States is that they're very apathetic. They're like, you know what? If it's not the Super Bowl, if it's not the VMA awards, if it's not the BET awards, like, I honestly don't give a fuck. Like, that's how the average American thinks. Am I calling the average American stupid? Absolutely not, because Mao taught us that we never, ever say that the people are stupid. But Americans and other, like, people that live in the imperial core are bought off, if you will. Like, they receive a higher standard of living as a consequence of these being imperialist countries. So we're seeing what's going on in Niger. Like, Niger just threw out the French ambassador and stole all of the croissants that were meant for the embassy.
Did you hear what French said in response?
What?
They said, okay, we're leaving, but if anything goes wrong, you can't blame it on us anymore.
Well, that's bullshit, because you can blame almost everything that goes on and goes wrong in Francophone Africa on France. Like, people really dump on the Brits, but they act
You're
as if
speaking
France,
my language.
But they act as if France is like some, just because they chopped off their king's head, that France is some type of like Republican paradise. Like, no, they massacred the communards, the first communist government in history. They did horrible things to the people of Vietnam, West Africa.
They killed Gaddafi. Yeah, they started that. They're the ones who actually intervened and got the conflict started. It wasn't the United States. Yeah, so it's like, if it wasn't for France, it wouldn't have happened.
Well, so I guess the slogan is not, when you see two neighbors fighting, an Englishman visited them. But when you see two neighbors fighting, a Frenchman visited them yesterday, huh?
Pretty much.
I've never heard that before.
The stupidity, though, to go back to that, this is a side effect of the Cold War.
Everything is.
They're so terrified they would learn that communism went well in a country that they couldn't let us learn geography.
Yeah, like all of these conflicts, like the Korean issue, India, Pakistan, like these are the results of like the Cold War and the immediate fallout. Like, the collapse of the Soviet Union was probably the biggest geopolitical disaster of the 20th century. Like, it started so much shit. Like, Azerbaijan literally just wanted to that exclave, Nagorno-Karabakh. It looks like the highway of death. Like, you have all these cars on this highway, like, leaving. Otherwise, the Azerbaijanis were going to slaughter them all. I don't know what it is with, like, that area of the world and fucking with Armenians, but, like, those people just can't get a fucking break.
Yeah, no, they really can't. But the fall of the Soviet Union also sparked the Yugoslav genocide. Wars as well, and the genocide there. So, like, all of that stuff together. I just wanted to, could you define Maoism for us? I'm curious.
Well, there's several different definitions, but my definition of Maoism is that it's, like, people think that Maoism is everything that Mao did. No, because Mao did some objectively stupid shit. Like, people ask, like, why there's no Maoism in Africa. It's because Mao fucked Africa over heavy, because his sort of second in command, Lin Biao, basically fucked him over and then tried to defect to the Soviet Union. And his plane ended up crashing, or it was shot down. I've never read Project 571, but some fucky shit happened, and Lin Biao ended up crash landing in Mongolia and dying. So after that, Mao had a hard right wing swing in terms of foreign policy. A lot of people blame it on Zhou Enlai, and I think that there's merit to that. But like, Mao ended up on the same side as the Rhodesians and the Americans in Angola, because the notion was that the Soviet Union is enemy number one, United States is enemy number two, which is kind of understandable from geopolitical reasons for the Chinese, because America is all the way across the Pacific Ocean. The Soviet Union is right there. So it was basically geopolitical opportunism that led to all of these foreign policy errors from a communist point of view. But back to your question, Jack, Maoism is basically Marxism-Leninism for the 21st century. And I know it sounds like I'm trying to sell you something, but
that's what I want.
But basically, like, it answers the question, like, why did the USSR end up basically stagnating after Stalin died? And am I the biggest Stalin fan? Absolutely not. Neither was Mao. Stalin did some objectively stupid and dare say evil bullshit, like removing entire ethnicities from their ancestral homelands. That's why the Chechens cannot stand Russia to this day. Maoism basically arose out of the Cultural Revolution, which was Mao's attempt to sort of, people say that it was his attempt to consolidate power or come back to power within the Chinese Communist Party after the errors that were made during the Great Leap Forward. But it actually demonstrated that once you make a revolution, a new ruling class can actually come out of the party. So that explains why, like, in the Soviet Union, it had the nomenklatura, all of these upper level party members who were eating nice caviar and living in dachas, luxury vacation houses, while the average person lived in crumbling apartments. I mean, the apartment was free, but it wasn't exactly like a place you would be like, hey, this is a nice place to live, because both countries, the USSR and the US and eventually China, ended up with nuclear weapons. So they were like, you know what? It isn't 1917 anymore. We could all fucking die. So Maoism is basically the principle that the most important part is that once you have made a proletarian revolution, it's important to mobilize the people to prevent the return of the old ruling class or the rising of a new ruling class from within the Communist Party. So the key thing with Maoism is that class struggle continues to exist under socialism. And the tankies that you all don't like, the genocide denialists and all those other sorts of people, they don't believe that. That's why you have them saying objectively stupid things like, oh, China is still socialist. They're carrying out socialism with Chinese characteristics.
This is exactly what I wanted to ask. Is we look at Xi's rule now. Basically, it sounds like everything that's literally the opposite of what you said. Like, it's like the anti-Maoism in a way. And a lot of people compare him to Mao, and I think from your perspective, you would probably say he's the most anti-Mao leader that China's had.
She doesn't really have an ideology. She is basically he's a party technocrat. Like, some people even call him a fascist. I don't think that's an appropriate definition. But, like,
Jack does.
Well, maybe Jack is to the left of me. But no, Xi is basically like, he's an old school party man. Like, he's basically, he's a businessman. Like, that's the thing. The Chinese Communist Party is supposed to be the party of the proletariat. But you have people like Jack Ma and like billionaires, multi-billionaires who got rich through the exploitation of workers, both Chinese workers and workers overseas. So once you have a Communist Party that's actually allowing literal exploiters, landlords, etc. into the party, that's what we call a revisionist party, because they've revised the basic principles that the party was supposed to have been founded on. Mao would not like the current state of the Chinese Communist Party. Knowing Mao, he probably would organize a bunch of college students and go back to Jingdongshan and attack. Of course, he'd probably die because the Chinese, the PLA is not as he left it. But I mean, like, Mao literally said that if his country ended up fucked like it is now, he would literally make wage another revolution. Of course, Mao was also given to exaggeration, but like, he would not be happy.
Well, I was going to just say, like, you look at like America's foundations, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, obviously, like, slavers, you know, many of them did genocide, those types of
all
things.
All of them.
But
did
you
genocide.
Also look at the foundation of principles. And you can still, like, in our education, they get redeemed, obviously. But you know what I mean? It's like, there's comparable faults in all name a based foundation of any state. No state has been founded and it's been like, oh, this is awesome. Nothing bad happened, you know?
I mean, the PRC is pretty dope, but, like, they also came out of a very brutal civil war. But
there you go, though. That's what I'm talking about. That's
in many cases.
That sucks.
In many cases, in many cases, civil war is necessary. So you had the Kuomintang. These guys were literal, like, these guys were basically the mafia organized into a political party. So you had those people. Would you have those people still in charge of China like they are in Taiwan?
Taiwan is a lot different now. And that's another thing, is just looking at the directions that both countries went.
Yeah, but like Chiang Kai-shek and the KMT ran Taiwan as a dictatorship up until like the early 80s. So like nobody wants that shit. And ironically, Stalin actually supported the KMT over the Chinese Communist Party. Like,
that's pretty funny.
He called Mao a cream of wheat Marxist. And I think one of
them, Stalin, was always siding with fascists.
I think it was Molotov or one of them that dumped on Mao because Mao had never read Capital. So yeah, the relationship,
that's between, where it comes from.
The relationship between the Russians and the Chinese was not always, like, it was like a big brother little brother relationship. And Stalin actually wanted to divide China in half. Like, he wanted to pull a North Korea in China. He wanted to give the southern half, he wanted to give the southern part of China to the KMT. And he wanted to let the communists hang out of the north. Like, what, bruh? Like, how can you just be like, we're gonna, like, how can you just be like, how, first of all, how can you divide somebody's country like that? Like, the Chinese don't want to be divided, but you, big brother, is just gonna be like, you know what? You Chinese do not need unite. You, Jiang, get south because you are friend. Irritating Mao, get north. Bim, problem fixed. Like, how the fuck can you do that? What the Cultural Revolution was about was getting rid of old feudal culture, like foot binding, Confucian shit, which basically means that, hey, you should let your parents dictate the course of your entire life. Like, that's what Confucianism is, in major part, filial piety, all that shit. Like, old feudal type culture, opium smoking, like all of that old shit, because Maoists believe that culture has the stamp of the society that produces it, right? For example, when you read works from the medieval English period, okay, or from medieval Mali, you don't hear about peasants or bandits, because those were the bad guys, right? Those were the people who were being exploited. You hear about kings, nobles, knights, ladies in waiting. So those were the people who controlled society. So what the purpose of the Cultural Revolution was to replace the old feudal culture. It's like, no, you have proletarian working class Chinese culture, you have peasants Chinese culture, then you have the Chinese culture of the ruling class up until 1949, of these landlords, these huge businessmen, these sellouts. That was the culture that the Cultural Revolution wanted to wipe out, because the notion is that why are we still talking about these people who have been removed from power when we're in a supposed socialist state? So it wasn't about destroying anything but the old culture, the culture of the exploiters. That's what it was. So
where does the traditional simplified Chinese come from? Because that came out of the Maoist era, did it not?
Yeah, that was actually so that peasants could be able to read and write easily. Because back before the revolution, the only people that could read and write were landlords and mandarins, Qing dynasty officials and such as that. So yeah, it was actually an attempt to expand literacy to the masses. Okay. That's where the simplified. Yeah, that's where the simplified characters come from. Mm.
How do you think?
Because Taiwan's still traditional, right? They still use the traditional Chinese. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
If I recall correctly, yeah. I
thought so, yeah. John?
How do you feel about now that China's basically is just doing landlords all over the place and investing heavily in these property conglomerates?
You mean the United States and Canada?
I mean everywhere. Australia.
That's what Imperial. I've heard several Australians complaining about that. They're buying up our country. But xenophobia aside, like that's what imperialists do. They export capital. The Japanese back in the day, they did that. They used to come over here and buy up every fucking thing in the 80s. Same thing. Arab capital, they have to put that oil money somewhere. You can only build so many Dubais in the desert. So they come to the US and buy a fucking Citibank, or they buy the Empire State Building. Like that's what imperialism is. It's transfer of capital from one market to another.
I think that's a really good description of imperialism, honestly. Speaking about imperialism and being in the imperialist core, how does the DSA address this, being part of the imperialist core? What are their actual goals? Where do they actually see themselves organizing?
Depends on what caucus you talk to.
Oh.
It depends on what caucus you talk to. Like Mug, if I recall correctly, literally wants to destroy the American Constitution and replace it with another one. I mean, it's not funny. Like, it's actually pretty novel. Like, if you read their documents, you have traditional Marxist-Leninists. You have traditional social democrats who I would call liberals. It literally depends on what caucus you talk to. There's people that believe that the United States is incorrigible, that it cannot be reformed, and who will tell you in private that, yeah, they believe in revolution. But there's others who believe that it can be reformed. So that's the... That's part of being in a bit Big Ten organization. Like you have people who believe literally all sorts of things. But what I really like about it is that at the end of the day, there haven't been many splits or like, oh, you're a piece of shit or you're a revisionist trash or you're an incorrigible liberal. Like at the end of the day, we're still able to get together and talk and handle our business like grown politically conscious adults. That's what I like. Because coming from the Maoist movement where we used to split over every fucking thing, like that shit is stressful. Like that makes people not want to be involved in any type of politics at all, especially if you are like on the fringe of the fringe and nothing that you do seems to change anything.
I would agree that you can't reform it, but it also just depends how far we're defining reform, you know? Because like technically, yeah, I would like to get healthcare, you know? Like if the revolution ain't coming tomorrow, you know, I need my healthcare. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So, but when we're talking about the long form reform, I mean, you look at everyone. What was the, what are they? The fear mongering with the Jack, the Klaus Schwab.
The 2030 agenda.
Yeah, the 2030 agenda. Have you seen this? This is what the Republicans are telling that people are going to eat bugs because of it. And basically, the guy is just trying to reform capitalism into like. So, like, you know, other things get into it, but it's still, you're not going to save the world with capitalism. The world's being destroyed, you know?
The world is being destroyed by capitalism. Anybody that thinks that you can save the world with capitalism, no matter how reformed, is an idiot. Like, it's had its chance. It's had its fucking day. We're in the age of imperialism now. Lenin said that imperialism is capitalism in decay. It's capitalism on its deathbed. Like, you can only open up so many markets. You can only cut down the Amazon until the Amazon is already fucking gone. Now you've got a desert. You can go in and you can clear cut the Congo. Now you've got another desert. So both of your major rainforests are gone. Now your CO2 output is going to just be hanging out there in the atmosphere. And if anybody's played Starfield, that's what Earth is going to look like. What do you fucking do?
Yeah, I mean, their policy now is like, maybe we can just contain capitalism, which, I mean, if you look at things like the Great Depression, I mean, it was nice for a while when they came out of that. They put some restraints on capital, at least for white people, you know, white men specifically after the Great Depression. You know, if we could get some constriction on capitalism, we might get by some a little bit more time, you know?
Yeah, but like we have very little time left to buy. Like, if you read climate scientists, like they say that like the horizon is slowly and slowly and slowly approaching, and soon it's going to be rapidly and rapidly and rapidly approaching the fucked horizon. So like how much time do we have left to buy? Like how long can we keep kicking the can down the road until, you know what, we're fucked, we're all fucking dead? Well, the Sinhalese might survive, but like the rest of us, ugh.
I always say that it's only a matter of time until they start realizing that China is one of the biggest contributors at this point, and they're pretty much the last one to come in line. Like their CO2 output is insane, and they're only increasing it.
Well, not as much as the U.S. military's.
I was about to say military is the U.S. military doesn't get to get counted. Yeah. Because they need it to maintain the shipping lanes.
Yeah.
So we can't put it on the documents.
America and the American military especially doesn't give a fuck.
No.
Like these billionaires, they would sacrifice. Like the thing is, like the consequences of climate change, the human real consequences, like we just literally had a massive flood that wiped
Libya
11,000 people. Like imagine 11,000 people. Okay, Katrina killed like maybe I think just under 1,000 people. So imagine 11,000 people in fucking Italy or Greece or France or the United States dying. The people be like, oh, that's so horrible, where can I donate it? It didn't make the news. Yeah. And then like these coastal areas, the littoral in North Africa, like those are very extremely densely packed areas. Like in North Africa, you can't put 11,000 people in the middle of the fucking Sahara Desert. So all of these people are crowded along the coast. So you've got like, this is literally one of the biggest natural disasters of the 21st century, and nobody is talking about it because the consequences of our actions in the first world. We got two Americans and an Aussie here, so we're first worlders. Like, our consequences are being exported to the third world. So most of our people here don't think that we're fucked until we start feeling shit. It's going to take a fucking tsunami coming and swamping New York or Los Angeles being rent in half by the San Andreas Fault. Of course,
you need a 9/11 event.
Yeah, literally.
Yeah. Yeah, like Libya, that was
literally something on that scale.
Like Libya was five 9/11 in terms of death toll. So and Americans especially are like insulated from that. Like our news is basically propaganda. Like I found out about what happened in Libya. Same thing. Like I found out what's happening in Armenia from Twitter. That's why do you think Elon Musk bought Twitter and is slowly destroying it? First of all, I just want to make sure y'all ain't fucking with me. Like, hey, look how we embarrassed this fucking Maoist.
No.
I mean, not that I would give a shit, but
no, we're all good faith.
But like, I also come from a background where like I was like researching like terrorism, so it's kind of like
no fly for you.
Oh yeah, this is something we were joking about because I was clicking links the other day because we were talking about something about ISIS. And I clicked a link and it opened a download document after clicking a link. And I'm like, oh, fuck no. It's like they're going to come knocking on my door and be like, hey, your passport says you went to Syria and you clicked an ISIS link. Like, fuck no.
I mean, there were a lot of pasty people in Daesh.
Oh, yeah. So a third of them actually spoke English. That's why I was able to like get in there and like do a bunch of stuff because they were just all idiot kids from the West.
I remember reading about it was a group of them. They called them the Beatles.
Yeah. Yeah.
From like Liverpool or somewhere.
And you know the videos of them beheading people, right? You know, it took them all day to shoot it because they like did it on a sound stage. It was inside on a film set. It was they couldn't even get the beheading on camera because they botched it, right? And like I was one of the only people who said, this is a sound stage. The lighting is unnatural. And everyone said I was a conspiracy theorist. I was right the entire time. Two of those guys are still alive, And they're being put on trial for like crucifying people.
Jesus Christ.
Don't you just love the 21st century? I don't think that's the first time an Englishman has ever beheaded or crucified anyone. Mm-mm. But
the things England has given us.
The thing is, don't talk about your ancestors like that. I've seen worse stuff than anything that's gonna happen if the Republicans win, you know. Like, obviously I don't want that, but like it's better than
nobody cares,
you know.
Nobody cares what you want, John.
I can always leave. I can always leave and join ISIS. I don't know. Why would you do that? Al-Shabaab's doing great right now, you know. They got one of the best bomb makers in the world.
You people are insane. People say I'm crazy. People say I'm crazy because I'm a Maoist.
I don't know. That's pretty up there.
I just want to feel something again.
Well, take a hammer and hit yourself in the temple with it.
No, but seriously, how does the DSA, like, what are their goals? You said depending on what caucus, but you personally, like, what do you want to see in the future here?
Honestly, I just want to stop the horrible things that are happening. Like, part of the reason that I joined was because, like, the hard left, the MLs and MLMs aren't really doing anything. Like, what victories do we have to our credit anywhere in the first world? Like, we always talk
about
House
Progressive Caucus. Sorry.
Yes, AOC is a secret Maoist.
Yes.
Yes. As soon as all I got to do is push a button on my cell phone and she's going
to activate it.
And she's going to jump up and shoot Kevin McCarthy in the head. Anyways, my personal goal is like as I read more and as I hang out and talk to more people, I'm eventually starting to realize, you will eventually start to realize that like ultra left shit, like just spray painting Free President Gonzalo on a wall or even on the Peruvian embassy, that's not doing anything productive. It's edgy. A lot of these people, they have a more revolutionary than thou notion of politics. And anything that violates their sacred principles is revisionist and horrible and needs to be destroyed. But as you become older and as you develop politically, you'll become a pragmatist. Like, you'll start to realize that, hey, I just wasted the last fucking 5 years of my life in some god-awful political cult. And you'll start to realize that, hey, we actually have to take measures to stop people from suffering now. Talking about a revolution in the hereafter or praying to mystery gods, aka communist theoreticians, doesn't help anybody. And one thing I like about my DSA comrades is that they realize and they're actually taking steps like organizing tenants, organizing workers, stuff that everybody agrees with. Everybody doesn't agree with protracted people's war tomorrow. As a matter of fact, most people would probably think you're stark raving nuts. So am I a reformist? Absolutely. But Lenin said that, especially in the imperial core where we have like bourgeois democracy, like we shouldn't be afraid to use it because otherwise we're abdicating the struggle to the fascists. Like, you've got people like Marjorie Greene, George Santos, girl in the movie.
Lauren Boebert. I knew who you were thinking. So
don't forget Matt Gaetz.
And Matt Gaetz. Like, you've got all these fucking lunatics and grifters in Congress. Like, if you are a Maoist and you think your politics are so advanced and so revolutionary, like, why don't you put them before the people in an election? Because you're afraid that you'll come off as crazy and the people won't vote for you? Change your politics. Like,
it's pretty easy, isn't it?
Like, stuff like that, PPW, Protracted People's War, that only works where, like, you look at the Philippines, okay, when you talk to the Filipinos, they will actually tell you, like, this is probably not going to work in your country. It works in our country because we are a heavily rural country. We are a country that is governed by the same people. Like, you've got fucking Bongbong Marcos, the old dictator's son. He runs shit now. Like, there's no facade of democracy over there. And if you say the wrong thing, like, if you say long live the CPP over there, they will literally send a death squad to your house, kick in your door, and shoot you in the back of the head. That's why the Filipinos have to make a revolution. Over here, you can stand on the corner and burn the flag and talk about long live President Gonzalo all you want. Then nobody's going to fuck with you. Like, that's the thing that gets me. These people have a persecution complex. Like, they arrested us because we said long. No, they arrested you because you were disturbing the peace and irritating people. And you punched a guy in the face because he laughed at you. The hard left in this country is just so unserious and silly. It's not, it's amateurish, as Leonard would say. So we have
to. This is my problem. Because coming back from a country with no development into this country and just looking at the left, it's Syria's also a war zone.
Yeah, it's been a war zone for the past 13 fucking years. I can't even imagine that. Imagine your city just like being a fucking Royal Rumble site for 13 fucking, like, there's not going to be anything left.
There's only like a few square meters of the country that haven't been affected by bombs.
That's horrible. Insane.
Like where people live, because there are like, you know, straight out in the desert. I wanted you to expand on something because you're getting into it, but you hear that this is, maybe you don't, because we obviously watch a fascism generation machine to make fun of these people, but they do this thing. I think Jordan Peterson is one of them, where they say that communism and Marxism is like a religion. Right. And there's,
I mean, some people certainly treat it like a religion.
So that's that's what you were commenting on, is it feels to me sometimes that these people think as long as you read more scripture, you're a better communist.
You've got people who are useless who have read all of Marx. You've got people who are dope ass revolutionaries who haven't read any Marx. Like, it's not a matter of reading. Okay. And I think part of it is that, because a lot of the hardcore Marxist left in the United States is petty bourgeois, as we would say. Like, they come out of universities, they have rich parents, like they have time to sit up and fight and worry over this shit. That's why there's so very few working class people who actually give themselves to Marxism, because it's like culturally alien to them. Okay, like if you're working class and you have a disagreement with somebody, you go up and you talk it out with them, and if the disagreement is strong enough, you might beat the shit out of them. Like, you don't write a 40-page denunciation quoting all of the correct scriptures. So the hard left in the United States, these little Maoist ML segments and fractions and shit, they're culturally alien to the working class. And yeah,
they're terminally online.
And they're terminally online. And yeah, in many cases, they do treat Marxist theory, which is meant to be a blueprint, it's meant to be a guide, but you have to apply it like within your actual conditions. Otherwise, you're going to just be a live action role play group. Like, I've seen people literally walking around wearing Mao suits or wearing the Red Army hats. And I'm like, bruh. So yeah, in many cases, like people, especially like younger people, people like Eddie Liger, they treat it like a religion.
Yeah, because you mentioned acting like a cult, and it's exactly how I felt after looking back and being like, why did I ever listen to these people? Because I came from like that libertarian side of things. It's exactly the same.
He watched Tim Pool before I de-radicalized him.
Yeah.
Well, good. You've done some good things with your life, John. You've de-radicalized an Australian.
One soul at a time, you know.
Yeah, you de-radicalized
him. Way.
You de-radicalized him before he could get into a truck and mow down 15 people outside of Starbucks.
I look at a lot of like economic development, and when we were talking about climate change before, so there's this like intersection between, especially like, because obviously we're talking about Africa here. You have jihadism and climate change intersecting here that are going to combine with immigration, right? So yeah. The people who are the most pro-capitalist in the country are also the most anti-immigrant and also the most afraid of ISIS. And I mean, they're planning on this right now. ISIS knows this is coming. So if you cannot believe in climate change all you want, ISIS believes in it.
Yeah, like ISIS is an extremely like interesting group. Like, it came out of the absolute fuckery that we pulled off in Iraq. Like, if Saddam was still around, ISIS would be was. But like, they came out of nowhere. They developed this huge social media presence. They radicalized thousands of kids, like people, and these kids were not all Muslims, or they were not like raised as Muslims.
Yeah.
Like, you had basic ass white kids, and there's a major intersect between the alt-right and the groups that developed out of the alt-right, Autumn Waffen and all those types of people, and ISIS. like the guy, one of the guys that founded this, this group, like literally thought that ISIS was dope.
We have we actually have an episode we did with Popular Front is about this type of stuff. There's one of those groups. It's a Satanist group, but they're literally communicating, I think, with Al-Qaeda.
The Nine Angles? ISIS.
Yeah.
The Nine Angles?
Yeah, that's the one.
So that's they told it, like, ISIS knows, Russia knows as well, that, like, these groups, but Adam Waffen is worthless. Like, you look at the Atlanta, they stopped a train. Adam Waffen has been trying to stop a train since they started and have failed continuously. The FBI gets him on the way to their attack while they have all the plans and guns on him every time.
Yeah, it's easy to meme and lol at them, but, like, they've also, like, they've got bodies on them. Like, they murdered
a Jew. Killed people.
They murdered a gay Jewish kid. Blaze Bernstein, I believe his last name was. Like, murdered this kid and threw him in a ditch. Like, they're very dangerous and fucked up people. But, like, yeah, in terms of big attacks, for one, they're too small. And for two, they're, like, they're idiots. But idiots can kill people.
Mm-hmm. Doesn't take much to pull a trigger.
Nope. You will never feel that joy because you're Australian.
He loves guns. Oh, the government took away his guns.
Didn't they take away a lot of y'all's gun rights after some idiot shot up a tourist trap or something in Tasmania?
Yeah, basically. You pretty much nailed it. Yeah. It happened in 12 days. The legislation passed in 12 days. They were taking people's guns in 12 days. Yeah. And if you read the laws, they're fucking ridiculous. They're so dumb.
You should come here.
He's trying. Look, I was there in 2019. I went.
We
to
get registered as a nonprofit. We can get him that visa. So
yeah, because I was at University of South Carolina in 2019. So I was there for 6 months.
A foreign exchange student.
Yeah, South Carolina was very interesting. I got there, I think, 12 months after they took the Confederate flag down from the fucking state capitol. So that's what a state to pick.
What is that shit like for you? As, like, especially from an outside perspective, like seeing, like, monuments to insurrectionists here.
Oh, it's wild. There was a plaque. There was a plaque on the university campus to who's the main Southern general?
Robert E. Lee.
Yeah. Yeah, there was a monument to him, just a little plaque on the university grounds. It was insane. The state capitol has just, like, Southern generals and shit down the, like, monuments down the thing. A beautiful park, weird choice of statues.
The funny thing is, like, your country still, like, don't you all still idolize, like, Ned Kelly and all those Bush Rangers?
Well,
and
okay,
shit?
Ned Kelly.
Oh, here we go, the genocide denial.
No. Ned Kelly's an interesting story because he was more anti-police, anti-government than he was, like, a government agent.
Your whole country is anti-police and anti-government. Yeah. You were founded by literal prisoners.
Yeah. You're not wrong. But there are also a lot of people that are descended from people who did and still apologize for the stolen generation, and I'm sure you're aware of what that is.
What? Yeah, white Australia and all that.
Fucking insane. Yeah, they apologized for it, but, like, that's gonna fucking do anything, right? And now they're going through this voice to parliament thing, and the entire country is gonna vote against it pretty much because the media has been campaigning like crazy. And all the disinformation agents are spreading all this bullshit. They get their token Aboriginals that are saying the points that they want them to say. And it's insane. It's so crazy. And it's not going to pass because this country is still insanely racist.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, people don't realize
it. We're talking about the country that gave the world Rupert Murdoch and Alan Bond. Of course you are.
You know what's funny? He was born in the suburb across from me.
Oh.
Yeah, his farm is still there.
Is there a memorial? Oh, wow.
I don't think there's a memorial, but his sister, I think, did, like, a lot of philanthropy in the area, so she's got her name everywhere.
Oh,
so Murdoch is everywhere, but it's not him.
So yes, there is memorials for him there.
But all the papers are.
How do we
much
feel it. About memorials?
Pull them down.
I think it's no fine scratches. For soldiers. And
I think if it's a statue of an idea, like the Iwo Jima thing, is that the flag one? You know how it's sort of an idea. Mm-hmm. Statues like that, I think, are fine.
statues should commemorate the masses. Like, I would like a statue of an average, ordinary fucking worker or a sailor or something. Like, big. That's the thing that pisses me off about, like, former communist countries. Like, why do you have a big-ass honking statue of Stalin right in your town square? And why is he always so tall? Stalin was a short dude. As a matter of fact, Mao actually went off on one of his artists because, like, why do you always draw Stalin as taller than me? Like, Mao was 5'11". I think Stalin was like 5'5". Like, why do you always draw him as taller than me? Draw me as taller than him or draw us at equal height. I will make that concession. But stop making that manlet taller than me.
I didn't know that. That's funny.
Yeah. Mao was a funny guy.
Yeah. But I'm completely against statues and sort of commemorating individuals, because it's like, there's no way that person was a pure enough individual to warrant a fucking statue of them to memorialize them forever. There's no way.
Yeah, that's ridiculous dick writing, to be honest. Mm.
We're trying to tear down our Columbus statue here right now, and the Historical Society is fighting us against it.
Where is this?
Oh, it's I live in Syracuse, so it's like we have a place called Columbus Square, and basically when you go downtown, you almost always drive by this statue. Everyone wants it gone, trying to get it replaced with like Hiawatha or some shit. Like, fuck Columbus. The Iroquois gave us like our idea of democracy and Confederacy to begin with. So, like, to think that they stole it, they like to, James Monroe wrote it like, oh, we got it from the Romans, the Greece, totally came from them, not people here already. Shut up. Everyone should know this.
The Romans and Greeks had fucking slaves. Well, this is America we're talking
about. Well, that's exactly why they wanted to say they got it from them, because then they could justify slavery, too. James Monroe sucks. James Monroe is one of the main people who extended, like, he had a choice. All of them had choices, but him especially had a choice to deal with slavery then, and instead he came up with, like, the compromise, right? I think it's the compromise of 1850, and then the Missouri Compromise. Both of these things extended slavery over America. And it got to the point where it had to have a war, because that's what these people do.
Yeah, I've been learning a lot about American history, a lot about the Native Americans, and a lot about the Civil War. It's great.
I used to be a Civil War history buff when I was a kid. I mean, it was the war that helped free my people, after all, even though we freed ourselves. But yeah, Civil War history is pretty cool.
It's very interesting. It's much more interesting than Australia.
My state, I live in Missouri. My state actually had like literal guerrilla bands. Like, you hear about Jesse James and Quantrill's Raiders. Like, you had Union and Confederate guerrilla bands, like, basically just riding around slaughtering the shit out of each other and sacking towns.
Fucking hell.
But like, I think Matt Walsh tries to say this, where he's like, the only reason women have a right to vote is because of white men. And it's like the abolitionist movement, like the Underground Railroad, like it wasn't like because of white people fighting for slavery. Like, the foundations had to be built for those people to then adopt the ideas.
Yeah. If it wasn't for the abolitionist movement, like, the struggle for women's suffrage, like, would have been.
That's where most of those... Nobody knows this. I love you right now. Go off.
So you brought me here to confess your undying love and loyalty to me. Is that it?
It is now.
Oh, dear. But, like, seriously, like, all of those people, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Susan B. Anthony, like, they were all abolitionists. Were they still racist? Yeah, most abolitionists were extremely racist. But they were inspired either by economic considerations. Hey, maybe we should not have millions of people in slavery and expect to develop a working class. Or, like, it was for religious reasons. Like, hey, this entire country is going to go to hell. Are the Africans fully human? Absolutely not. But are they partly human? Absolutely yes. So maybe we should give them a reservation in Panama or send them back to their homeland. So, but just get them the fuck out of here. So, like, most of those abolitionists were still racist as fuck. But, they got political organizing experience through that. The only, like, hardcore abolitionists that I would say, like, were actually useful politically were the Quakers. Like, they actually would throw down.
Yeah.
And, of course, you also had people like John Brown, who was probably, like, who every abolitionist should have aspired to be, but most abolitionists thought he was fucking nuts.
I've talked to you about this before, that I think more people should be worshiping Frederick Douglass over John Brown. And even Frederick Douglass said the John Brown way was necessary as well. So, like, I think both are good in different ways. Yeah.
John Brown was literally the vanguard.
It's true.
Yeah, he was literally the vanguard. Of course, he, like John Brown's fort, it was literally the abolitionist Alamo. But sometimes you just have somebody, you have to have somebody that gives history a push.
Yeah, there's always those people.
Every expansion of human rights in this country has come with, like, mass violence. You know, like the women's suffrage movements, it's like Bloody Tuesday or Bloody Thursday or something. They sent the police into Seneca Falls, like, disfigured women, broke their arms and shit.
You had people, you had them barbarically force feeding suffragists. You had people chaining themselves to the White House fence. The police would come and just yank them off. And, like, horrible shit went on. The civil rights movement, that was extremely violent on both sides. But, like, people think that the civil rights movement was just like, oh, everybody's peaceful and these innocent poor black snowflakes are being beaten for no reason. Like, no, half of those protesters had guns. Like, Martin Luther King's house was literally full of guns. A reporter named William Worthy, like, literally almost sat on one. Malcolm X, you have that famous picture of him with the rifle looking out his window after his house had been firebombed. There's actually a couple good books. One is called We Will Shoot Back. I believe it's by Charles Cobb. And you've got That Nonviolent Shit Will Get You Killed by Akinyele Umoja, I believe his name is. Very good books about the role of firearms in the civil rights movement. And that's, like, one of the major reasons why I oppose gun control efforts, because, like,
me as well.
Yeah, like, that's why they took guns away from us. That's why when Martin Luther King, who had several credible threats against his life, went down, he always tried to do stuff the right way. He went down to the police station to apply for a gun permit, and they told him no. You literally had Klansmen circling this man's house, flashing their guns out the windows, and they would not allow him to have a firearms permit. So he's like, fuck it, we're doing it illegally. So, yeah, I will forever be supportive of the rights of black people and all people in this country to arm themselves against any threats.
I'm going to go back to climate change, but before I do that, I just wanted to say the island, right, of New York City. There's
Manhattan?
Like, just the whole thing down there. They can't get guns on the island, but they had, like, you know, stop and frisk, obviously. But their handgun law here, or there specifically in the city, it basically said, I think it is the whole state. They said that they can refuse the permit for whatever reason they want. They're doing the same thing with marijuana here now, too. So they're disenfranchising black people from owning marijuana grow operations here now, too. So yeah, these laws were passed to arrest people.
That liberal New York.
That legalized marijuana shit, that is not to help black people. That's to help like rich white millennials and rich white Zoomers get even more rich and invest daddy's money. That's what that's for.
Yeah, and it also, the cartel switched right to heroin when that shit started getting legalized, so.
Yeah, well, what little real heroin is left? Look, I work in a homeless shelter. Like, there's very little real heroin. All of them are on trank dope or fentanyl.
Crazy.
And it's not like they grow poppies in Mexico, so you think that might have something to do with it?
It might. Like, this book I'm reading, The CIA's Organized Crime by Douglas Valentine, he said that if Trump built a wall across the U.S.-Mexico border, the CIA would build escape hatches under it. Like, all of these cartels are literal, like, they're literal CIA assets.
Yeah.
That's why they haven't been destroyed. And you've got these fucking Republican morons talking about invading Mexico.
Drone strike the cartels.
You're already there. Like, Los Zetas was trained by the Navy SEALs.
Yeah. They used to be Mexican special forces until they decided that, you know what, we can make some big fucking money. Like, those
what
are
was
like the fucking...
What was the cartel that was trained to take out the Zapatistas?
Zetas.
That was the Zetas. Okay.
Yeah, the Navy Mexican, SEALs. Yeah. The Navy SEALs, they were already enforcers. The Navy SEALs brought them in again to do ops against the CIA, everyone wants to think that they armed, like, it's their fault for Bin Laden and stuff like that. Nobody wants to talk about the heroin operation they opened up in Afghanistan.
Yeah. Yeah. Like you can literally talk to any like US soldier that was over there and they'll tell you about the fucking poppy fields. Like they were like you could literally not eradicate that shit.
Yeah. That's why we don't believe the Taliban have done it. Also, I've seen videos of them processing it.
Oh no, that's too much. Look, it doesn't matter what your ideology is. You're not going to leave fucking billions of dollars on the table. It doesn't like Mao actually, when he was in Yan'an, they actually were growing and selling opium up there. Like, it doesn't matter if you're communist, capitalist, fascist, whatever. That's too much money in dope. You're not going to leave that. You're not going to go burn all that shit up, man.
Yeah, the Taliban are doing it to increase the price of it. That's what they do. It's the first thing they did when Omar came to power the first time. So, but to go to climate change. We're talking about basically the nature of violence. And then you have these Extinction Rebellion kids that think that spilling soup on a painting that's covered in glass and then sitting in front of cars at Burning Man is going to stop climate change. How do we feel about this nonviolent action going on with climate change protesters, though?
I mean, they're trying to do something. They're doing more than most people are. Most people, well, not most, but a substantial chunk
of
people.
Very nice of you.
A substantial chunk of people in this country don't even believe climate change is a thing.
That is true.
So like, I mean, I wouldn't go too hard on them, but I would definitely maintain a principled criticism. Like, hey, what the fuck you're doing is stupid. They're just going to wipe the soup off. And if you lay down in front of the wrong person's car, they're probably going to run you over and get away with it. So, like, you just have to talk to them. Like, most of these people, like you said, they're kids. They're very young. They think they're doing something.
Yeah, but those are the most radical ones. That's why they were so good at getting them in ISIS. Just keeping things full circle. So when I edit later, I can keep everything in.
You know what? I'm a black man in America. The police are probably going to fuck me up one day anyway. So I guess talking to you morons isn't going to do much worse.
I mean, Greta, I mean, she was saying when she started getting arrested, I think she was even advocating for, yeah, it needs to be further than what I'm doing.
Yeah, Greta's basically an anti-capitalist now. Her politics have developed quite a bit.
That's no surprise. Yeah, where she started and where she is now, that's to be expected. You know, you wouldn't expect her to turn around and be like, yeah, global capital, would you? Yeah, it's not... She's not going to go from limit carbon to produce as much as you want, companies. I don't think so.
To get to a wrap up, I wanted to say just basically like what is your foreseeable like political future? Like, what do you want to accomplish next?
Throwing both of you into a gulag.
I don't want to go into a gulag.
No. No, seriously though, no bullshit. I just want to win. Like, I want the left to actually start chalking up gains in this country, like the right has. Like, the right has, like, people who are, like, literal fucking Nazis in Congress. And the left, we're so caught up on our dogmatism and all of our other isms and schisms that, like, we keep getting fucked constantly. So I just want to start seeing the left win and actually start helping people. That's part of why I joined DSA.
Minnesota's doing pretty good.
Yeah, they're doing pretty good. Right.
They're the secret communists to Falun Gong totally is selling this like as that the Somali immigrants are turning Minnesota into a communist hell state.
Well, good. We need Somali immigrants everywhere.
I agree.